This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for December 29th, 2016, the Conundrum Gabfest. We're live at the Bell House in New York before a sold-out crowd. Before a sold-out crowd of morally confounded Brooklynites who are all wondering if it is ethical to get their I'm With Her tattoos laser removed before the Trump capos spot them. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I am joined on stage to my immediate left by Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine. Hello, Emily.
Hello.
And to Emily's left, John Dickerson of Face the Nation. On this week's Gabfest, if you could make one legal thing illegal, what would it be? Is it worse to cut down a tree or kill a dog? Should you make America better by marrying someone with reprehensible political beliefs? What's the best way to lie to avoid a social situation you don't want to be in? And more conundrums from you and from our live audience. And in Slate Plus, we'll do even more conundrums. If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus. One of our most popular conundrums ever was, would you rather be a fish or a tree? Different one today. Is it worse to cut down a tree or to kill a fish or a dog? What do you think?
Don't you think it's a big difference whether it's a fish or a dog?
Yeah. Good question.
Killing a fish, I don't bat an eye, and picking the fish. I have to think about the dog. Do you?
Well, I just want to go back to the historical record, which is that when I asked the fish tree, I gave the only right answer, which was dolphin. And you've already, and I was roundly criticized for adding dolphin in because
it's
dolphin might as well be a fish.
It's not a fish.
But, okay. Anyway, but you added dog immediately.
Yeah. What do you think? Is you think it's definitely better to kill a fish than to cut down a tree?
Yeah, I think we have to change the question. The dog question is more is harder for me.
Do you think what about
dogs? What if it's a goldfish?
What if it's a
300-year-old tuna?
There is no such thing. I feel strongly.
Yeah, this is a
forget the fish. I mean, really.
Okay, what about a dog? What about a dog?
I think it's
better to kill the dog.
I think it's probably utilitarian.
What kind of tree is it?
Is, but What kind of tree and how big and
yeah,
where
I mean,
is
are we
it?
Talking about a redwood or are we talking about some
what about like an oak tree
ambitious
on a city
weed?
Street?
An oak tree on a city street?
Yeah, or in the park.
That's a song. I think an oak tree on a city street because you want urban trees are very valuable. What if it's just a regular oak tree in the middle of a forest?
Right. Yeah. I mean, right. And then goes back into the soil and regenerates and another tree comes up. Because it seems like, okay, the argument for the tree is that it took a long time and a lot of effort on the part of lots of organisms to create that tree and less on the part of the dog. It has a shorter life. So that's the utilitarian pro-tree argument. But in the middle of the...
But Emily, the dog, unless this dog is just some random stray dog, or it's a dog at a shelter that's going to be put down anyway. This is a dog that is beloved by some people.
Right. Have
human.
A shelter dog.
Like if it's John's dog, then we pick the tree, right?
Of course, George would be very upset if you euthanized him.
If there were a tree in your yard, John, a beautiful big tree in your yard, and it was that or the dog.
Well, there's the better. That's the sharper question.
And,
okay.
Yes.
And what's the answer? Because we
your
don't
kids
have
are
dogs.
Listening.
Oh, and our actual dog. Oh, yeah. The tree would be the tree right. Wouldn't have a chance.
Yeah.
George, you can't imagine what George has done for the family life. Two crucial things. This is why you can't name a specific dog, because then doesn't that just totally put it on the dog's
it's
side?
It's only when it's some abstract.
Well, what if it was a specific tree? What if it was a...
So now it's a tree with a story.
It's a tree with a story, or the tree that my parents have a beautiful, huge tree that's right next to their house. It's going to fall on the house one day. We should have cut it down and not killed that dog, I guess. But
have you ever had a pet that you would kill? Well, actually, you don't like your cats, so that's not a good question for you. Have you ever had a relationship with a dog that you would kill the dog?
No, I guess not.
No, because the dog is almost, I mean, the dog is a member of your family. You
totally.
Don't
and
the tree is not a member of your family.
The great thing about the dog is when you have surly teenagers, the conversation about the dog is the one thing you can roughly all agree
on. And what if they come home to see a dog.
But what if the tree is home to a family of hawks, of goshawks?
Well, I mean, you can gussy up the story however you want.
Well, the tree is home to organisms.
And young hobbits nap under the shade of its...
Possibly.
Of its singing boughs. Well, I mean, I think we've lost the thread.
If it's an abstract dog, like in a pack of dogs, and some beautiful tree, we pick the tree, but only because we don't know the dog. Once you know the dog and care about the dog, you don't kill the dog anymore.
Okay, we're going to now do quick audience. Would you kill the dog or the tree? Well, first we'll ask, would you kill the dog? Would you kill the tree?
This is why a tree does not grow in Brooklyn.
I guess the Trump environmental policy is going to be successful. Okay, let's move on. If suspended animation, this is from Randy Plant via email. That's a great name, Randy Plant. If suspended animation were perfected and you could safely awaken unchanged after years of sleep, would you do it? If so, how far in the future would you want to go? Or in the past?
So do you get to take your family with you? I can't
Yes, say you can take your family
with you. Your family with
you. Yeah, because that would make it too... Right, okay, so you can take your family with you.
So, okay, so then what you're... Then the question is about whether you want to bet on the future because you're hopeful or curious about it, and whether all the other things that are familiar in your life you're willing to let go.
Right. Yes.
So that's much more interesting. So it's easy for me to dismiss this idea if I thought I had to abandon my family. I wasn't going to do that.
Right.
But now I get to take them.
But now if you pick too many years in the future, you may wake up in a time where you have to sell members of your family.
Right. Or there could only be cockroaches and
me. But don't you think, I mean, there is this thing, I think if you ask, would you rather go to the past or the future? To me, it's always you'd rather go to the future. The past was much worse. Everything is generally getting better. So don't you kind of assume that things are generally going to get better? You'll live longer, you know, better food. Generally things improve. Now, like, obviously
this
there are moments when things get worse.
Difficulty for that, both because of climate change and also the world's growing, perhaps, appetite for authoritarianism. It's making me feel more nervous about that choice.
Don't you think that's like beards that'll just go out of fashion? And if you wait long enough, authoritarianism will be totally passé.
I really hope so. But do you want to take a bet on it?
If you're a minority in America, oh, how many years from now?
2050. Sorry.
Wow. You anticipated, you went to the future just so you could answer my question.
I went to the future.
What was the question?
So the question was, how many years in the future will you be able to actually afford nostalgia? So in other words, if you're an African-American, you can't be nostalgic about like the 1880s.
Or right? even the,
or the 1960s. Right. So when do you get, when, how, because then it's not just like you can imagine when will we have, you know, true equality for everyone. That's A. But then B is when you can be, once you hit that point, then you have to have some number of years after which you could then be nostalgic.
Well,
about
but I think
period.
People have an enormous capacity to be nostalgic under almost any circumstance. They can always look back. And I think if, you know, I think if you're, you know, there are Jews who look back nostalgically to a halcyon 1950s, which doesn't seem to make sense to me.
No. More than 100? 100 seems to me like the max out I would want to go without worrying about things being too dystopic or unrecognizable. But maybe that's kind of like, maybe it'd be better to be like 500 years in the future.
I don't want to do this at all.
No, you want to stay.
Yeah.
Why?
Because I'm basically stuck in a rut.
How about because you're basically fulfilled?
Well, there's that, if that were true, yeah. No, that's. I think that's probably true.
You're
although
still
I'm
hosting
curious,
Face the Nation in the future, John.
Yeah. I think,
and your audience will be really, really
audience,
old.
Your audience will be 270.
That's,
we're winning in the demographic, which is 100 to 150. That was not a joke about Face the Nation. That was a joke about getting older.
It was too. What about you?
I think I and do you get to come back or not? I definitely would go if you.
No,
if you got
no,
to come
that
back.
You shouldn't be able to come back. No, you
that's
got to.
That's too
back.
Easy. Of course.
Oh,
you
then
go and
definitely
back.
Would not go. Would not go.
Because you're afraid of things getting worse, or because you like your life the way it is now.
I like my life more or less. I mean, I there are certainly things I could improve.
That's for sure.
But I don't know.
You
I don't think that going to the future
good.
Would necessarily
isn't it a lot to
make
give up
better.
That you I feel very curious about what it's going to be like. It's hard for me to give up the glimpse.
Right. That's why if
that's
I could
why
go
you
back,
come back.
You want to come back.
Well,
yeah.
Of course,
but I would
but
not this is kind of like the one way trip to Mars. I would never. Why would you take a one way trip to Mars? That would be terrible.
Right.
All right. Okay, we're going to go to our first audience question. Jody Avergan, where are you?
Hey, Jody.
Jody,
who's a presider of many great podcasts, but one that's called Ask Roulette. He has an Ask Roulette question.
What direction do you face in the shower?
I would like to say I don't think this is a conundrum, but it's an excellent question.
What direction should one face in the shower?
Okay, there you go. Thank you.
I face kind of sideways. But always
really?
To my
Why?
Left, my left shoulder.
Is always your shower really small or narrow? Why would you do that? Don't you like the feeling of the water on your back? I feel totally ambivalent about this.
You have a clear view.
What's the clear view?
I always have my back to the water because I like the feeling of the water hitting my back. No?
That's not a.
I don't like to turn around at all. Then I get water in my mouth. All kinds of things happen.
I like to place my face right on the shower head and then turn it on. It's the cheap exfoliation. Gosh, I hadn't... okay, so here is a challenge that may inform my thinking, which is that our shower is built at the edge of the house, and so in the winter, the wall at the exterior of the house is
cold.
Freezing.
So you do everything you can not to touch it.
Yeah. No, well, you have to just start the shower, you know, and let it run for a while before it gets warm in there. I don't know that I've formed an opinion or can.
You just like stand any old way. You don't have a pattern.
I'm sure I have a deeply systemic pattern, but I haven't focused on it.
I think I crossed my arms. I just realized.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Why?
Aren't I don't know.
Soap
it's
up?
Some kind of heat retention.
Huh.
God.
That's really.
But do you not move around? I mean, you can't have it against your back the whole time.
I move around a little, but I really like, I don't like having to turn around and get things. I always try to get back to that position as quickly as possible.
So the audience, so your choice will have vocal responses. One is face forward, two is face backward, three is sideways, like plots, and four is all over the place. So who faces forward? Who faces backward? Who faces sideways? and who wiggles around?
Don't make it seem so it's not wiggling around.
You've got plenty of cheers, don't worry.
Here's one. John, you don't have to answer this. Would you rather marry Ted Cruz or Tom Cruise?
I don't know why John is off the hook, but you don't have to answer if you don't want to. The deciding factor for me is that, like, basset hound, floppy, droopy face that Ted Cruz has. I just don't think I could
Ted Cruz.
I don't think I could look at that, although I definitely think that Tom Cruise is crazier, and I'd be more scared about the Scientology part of it.
Oh my! So you basically you're deciding you'd marry Tom Cruise because he's better looking.
Yeah, well that's obviously true. But I know it's like a particular aversion
I don't think
to
this
that.
Is based, well, maybe.
What about you?
It's Ted Cruz in a walkover. One, Ted Cruz is successfully married. He has children.
Tom Cruise has a child.
That's true, but he's not successfully married. He's highly unsuccessfully
married.
That's
because he hasn't met me or you yet.
Good point. Who is he more likely to marry? Another question, me or you. Ted Cruz is like married to a woman who appears to be normal and appears to be happily married to him, which is good evidence.
But he's odious.
But Tom Cruise is also odious. Tom Cruise is the acolyte of a totally horrific, you know.
Right. But I think I'm more interested in Hollywood. Like if I was like, think of the party, you get to go to some fun parties with Tom Cruise. Ted Cruz, not so much.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu. Okay, next audience question. Joni D. Are you in the house, Joni D?
I am.
Can you come to the mic?
How much accommodation is a home chef expected to do during the holiday cooking when you're cooking for a crowd?
Mm-hmm.
How much accommodation?
You should do some accommodating. I don't think that you are obliged to have a gluten-free Thanksgiving or a vegan Thanksgiving or a lactose-free Thanksgiving. I think you're obliged to offer some refreshment for someone who is gluten intolerant and lactose intolerant and vegetarian. But they cannot impose that their will on everybody, but you should accommodate them with some number of dishes. If you're already doing significant cooking, you do a little bit extra to make sure that there's something, a couple of things that they're going to be happy eating.
Do you need to tell vegetarians that there's chicken stock?
Yes. What about if your favorite dish has butter in it and you know there's someone who doesn't eat butter and you could make it with margarine or whatever and... It
no,
would
you don't
taste
have to
as
no,
good,
absolutely
but they
not.
Would eat it. Even if they look at you sadly.
Sorry,
every,
the flaw in your theory is it tastes as good.
So it doesn't taste as good, but
oh,
it
I'm sorry,
tastes
I missed that.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No.
Even if they look at you sadly year after year?
No, they've made their choice. They've made their life choices, and they live in a state of moral superiority to you.
And that should be sustenance
and
enough.
That should be sustenance enough, exactly.
I feel like
well
if
said.
It's pretty... good good. Like if it's bad, okay, no. But I think if it's like goes from being an A to a B plus, then you change the ingredients.
I think it's fine. You could make another one. You could make a second one. This is our mashed potatoes, and here are our lactose free mashed potatoes.
Like bread, and so you're that's like a project. You're not going to make
what
it.
What bread would be better with any of these things removed?
Now, I didn't say it would be better, but it would be edible. It would be
what?
Fine. Well, I was thinking of challah in particular. So,
but a challah what?
With milk and butter as opposed to margarine and water.
Eggs. Eggs are in challah too.
Yeah, yeah. No, forget. You can't make it without the eggs. It's not challah anymore. You could make something, but not that. Anyway.
What's your answer, John?
If you know you have somebody there who doesn't eat meat, you make the fish option, or you make the portobello mushroom option of the grilled thing you're making. And then they say, at a Thanksgiving where everybody might bring a meal, will say, you know, like my nephew who brought his tofu turkey sort of substitute, that was, you know, he was like, I'll bring it because I don't want a burden. And so then you both are showing on a, you know, your fellow feeling for the other. And it's a moment of national unity.
I think the most, my main appeal on this is to tell the home chef in advance. My worst hosting moments have been when people have walked in my door and announced, like, they're allergic to fish, which is the main, oh, sorry. Oh, don't worry.
Yeah, well, right. So that's the worst.
That's the worst. And then you're basically being a bad host, but it's really not your fault. That is really upsetting.
Yeah. But do you actually feel responsible when that person does that?
When someone is at your house for dinner and the main, they can't eat the main dish and there's like salad and I don't know, Brussels sprouts or cauliflower or something. Yes, I feel worried about that person.
No.
Salad.
No. Are Joni D, are you satisfied?
Very satisfied. I'll come over anytime.
Good. Okay. Did you ever have a moment in your life where you made a decision, a small decision that ended up changing the rest of your life? Like there's something you ended up doing, didn't know you would turn out to be, and it turned out to be enormous.
27 years ago at about this time, I was at college and there was a party, a holiday party, and the person I was sort of dating at the time couldn't go to that party, so I had to find a date.
Her loss.
So I asked a friend of mine who I'd, was a woman who was a friend of a couple years. We'd had an art history class together. She also had a party that she needed a date to, so it was great. We each had, like, we were each helping each other out on this night. At the time, the tradition, the norm was that you bring a bottle to the party. So we got a bottle of Southern Comfort. And and we brought the bottle to the party. That was all we brought, was the bottle, because it was empty. So that was 27 years ago. We've now been married for 21 years.
And does your ex-girlfriend feel glad that she happened not to be free that night?
Yeah. It wasn't that serious. It wasn't that serious. But here,
well, why do you think? But John, why is that a moment? I mean, well, you guys went to college together. Why wouldn't it, that you guys have met? I mean, all of us met our spouses. The three of us met our spouses, and we would have met them in some other fashion, perhaps. But why is that something which irrevocably you definitively would never have met Anne and never?
Well, no, I met her. She was a friend, but we might very well have continued being being friends. You know, and not had we not had that forcing instance to go and actually go out on a date together, which, because it was just basically we were taking care of each other's social obligations, we might have just gone on and kept being friends. And so,
did you have a little bit of anticipation before the date, like,
that's what the Southern Comfort was about? You know, I can't remember anything from the yeah, I'm sure I did. But we might also have just been fooling ourselves. So I don't know.
Well, I don't really want to follow that. This is so much more like mundane and petty, but I'll go ahead anyway. So when I was in high school, I played tennis for my school, and I played tournaments on the weekend sometimes, but I had a hate relationship. It wasn't something I chose. It was something that my dad in particular really wanted me to do. But it was very much a part of my life. It was really the only sport that I know how to play still, alas for me. And so when I went to college, there's no way I was going to make the varsity team, but there was a JV team that I was part of freshman year. And it was very comforting to have that routine. It was a routine I was really used to. And then my sophomore year, the JV team got cut and I wasn't good enough to play varsity. So I stopped playing tennis. And I really stopped because I didn't live near tennis courts anymore. It wasn't like, and it was the most liberating thing. I started writing for the college magazine, and I started working at the Women's Center, and I got a job, and got to be better friends, moved off campus, all the things about college that then became important to my professional and personal life kind of followed from that. And like, what if they hadn't cut the JV team? I'm so grateful to you, Yale University, for cutting the JV women's tennis team that year. That was really helpful.
That's right. Screw title name. Nice. I'm trying to think if I have one. I guess mine is tediously professional, which is that I think it was 2000 or 2001, I was up for a job to editing the city paper, the alternative weekly in Washington, where I had cut my teeth as a journalist. And I was offered the job. I was really excited to do it. I was succeeding David Carr, who'd been a mentor and friend of mine. I'd worked for him. I called the publisher of City Paper to accept the job, and I couldn't reach her. Like, it was pre-cell phone. I wasn't able to reach her. Then, I'm just going to sound like such an asshole here.
Then, too late.
Then I learned that I was a finalist for a prize for reporting. And that it was a prestigious prize. And I was like, for writing and reporting that I'd done. And I realized like, oh, I don't think I want to go be an editor now. I think I want to write and report. And so the publisher called me back and I turned the job down. And
stayed at Slate.
And like, and
then was that for the Harper's piece on South Carolina?
Yeah. Yeah. It was for that.
Great piece about gambling. Yeah. Gambling.
Well, wait, that doesn't sound that jerky.
I don't know, but it was because of the ego, like, oh, I'm a finalist for a prize.
Well, no, repeating.
But it was also realizing that you had success in something that you wanted to do more.
Yeah, but it wasn't the internal success of having written a good piece. It was the status of somebody recognizing it.
No, so that's, I think you're being too hard on yourself. I think
back sometimes. But what's interesting about that story is then you did become an editor.
Yes. So maybe it's not that life changing, actually.
Sorry to point that part out.
I think this is a really roundabout way to talk about that prize you won.
I didn't win. That was the thing, and I didn't win it.
Wow.
It was too late to accept the job.
Good story.
Okay.
It was a great story, though, the South Carolina one.
Yeah. Brian Mills asks us via email. I think I'm going to change this. Well, I'll modify it slightly. You get to have access to only one of these mediums for the rest of your life and must discard all others. Books. Podcasts, audiobooks not included, or television.
You have to live off one.
You have to live off one of those.
Yeah. Well, it's, I mean.
Books.
Books, yeah.
Television.
That's super. So we say that. Do we really mean that? Let's think about whether we really mean that. Oh, we really mean it.
Yeah,
we
really mean that.
And why? Why?
Because think about, you have a much wider range of global and human experience captured in books than in all of the recorded television that's been done. And then secondarily, if the interior life of books is a richer, which isn't to say that the immersive experience is more constantly accessible in books than in television, which isn't to say that television isn't deeply immersive in certain ways, but just not in the way that a book is.
Does this question, could you not read The New Yorker, for example? Is it all reading would be wiped out, or just the book form of reading?
I was thinking we were just talking about books, but it is true that we've left out whether you lose all other kinds of written material.
What if it was only periodicals or newspapers you had to choose?
Oh, periodicals.
You could only read periodicals or newspapers?
Yeah.
Oh, periodicals. Definitely.
In fact, yeah. Sometimes I want to switch to that now, even though I can read the newspaper.
I would definitely choose TV. I would definitely choose TV. I know,
why? Like,
because I'm not a smug, sanctimonious person.
No, but why? 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 Why?
Because I am honest enough to recognize that I spend a lot more time watching television and being absorbed by the emotional stories of television
and do you feel and like the sights and sounds of television.
And as long as I was able to read, as long as I was able to read a great Emily Bazelon story, I'm pandering to you now, great Emily Bazelon story in the New York Times magazine,
can I ask
I think it would be okay.
Can I ask the audience a question? Audience, stay with me here for a moment. Who among the three of us mentions the books they've read on the show more?
And is super fast at reading,
We'll
too.
Start with John. Emily. David.
What did you just prove?
You said you weren't a sanctimonious book person, but you mention books on the show all the time.
Because part of my job is to do cocktail chatter and to share with the good people here
also,
things
though,
I've enjoyed. I also mention a lot of TV shows that I watch.
That's true, but you read books so quickly and you remember them.
I know.
And retain
your
them. So you really think
like
that you get more pleasure from television? Like,
you're
truly?
A self-hating book reader.
I would not choose to give up books. This is not like a thing I'm looking forward to. But given, I'm honestly assessing, like, given the option, would I give up books over television? Yeah. Let's check the audience. Okay, you're gonna have your choice.
Wait, we have to do podcasts too, which is very sweet.
So which thing are you only going to consume? Is it going to be book, podcast, television? So the thing you are only going to consume. Who would only consume books? Who would only consume podcasts?
Oh, that's so great.
That's Andy
Bowers.
Baby
genre.
Andy Bowers is doing that. Who would only consume television?
Books one.
Books one? I think books one. Let's do one more from our list here. Sean Murray asks, a person physically pushes or hits you and other people in public. When you confront the person, they begin to take video of you on their phone. What do you do?
I mean,
this question struck me as odd.
Why? Because you can't imagine that happening? I could totally imagine that
I can't
happening.
Imagine it happening repeatedly.
You mean like one hit and then...
Well, no, I just think the way I read it, or maybe the way it was asked, those are two different possibilities. It made it seem like this was happening a lot in Sean's life.
No, I think you imagine it happening.
Okay, it just happens once.
Person.
And then they start.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I mean, what would you do, Emily?
You become much more self-conscious, I think. And probably you try to be less aggressive and tone it down. And you imagine then you're performing and that whatever's being taped could be used against you in some unknown situation.
What I find weird about the question is that you're clearly the victim and then the aggressor is then filming you, right?
Right, but presumably you've come back from being the victim and you're trying to stand up for yourself or fight back or you're yelling at the person. Otherwise, it doesn't really make sense if you're just like lying on the ground.
What if you see a cop doing bad things and you film and you start to film that cop and the cop stops? Do you stop?
The
cop tells you to stop filming.
Oh, no, you don't stop. Well, I mean, it depends how nervous you are for your physical safety. No, you don't have to stop filming. You can keep filming.
No, you can. Do you?
I mean, I hope that, you do. If you're seeing something, you think, I mean, then they've turned their attention to you. So then they're not doing what they were doing, unless it's another cop. I think that it's really, if you can possibly keep filming, then you keep filming.
You know, you know what we didn't ever wrestle with once was I once saw this father just reaming out his like 10-year-old son in every possible swear word,
so just
abusive
words,
bullying.
But scary.
Well,
words.
I mean, like words enough to make me, nervous, and I wasn't the 10-year-old boy. No, I just kind of got out of the car and kind of walked in their area, and so he like ultimately kind of stopped. But I want to know what the approved response.
And was this somebody you knew or not?
No, somebody was playing on the opposing baseball team of my son. But right, I mean, what's best practices here at the?
That's a hard one because you might be making it worse by intervening. On the other hand, if you are physically there, then you're a part of the interaction in some way. And if you don't speak up, then you're making it seem like you.
But
think
what's
it's
the,
okay.
What is this? What's the speaking up that you would do? That would not make it worse. I'm not.
I mean, you could try to
that's
say,
not the right
"Hey,
thing to do.
In a very calm way, like, hey, calm down." So, but people don't like to be told to calm down.
Yes, they don't like to be told to calm down.
But so,
our
seriously,
listener JM said just that you just say, "Hey, everything okay here?"
Ah,
like you. That would.
That's much better than "Hey, calm down," because it's open ended.
What if you knew the person? Do you have some obligation to go to that person's spouse, to go to them and talk to them about it, to go to authorities at school, authorities What is your obligation under that circumstance?
That's a good question. You can tweet about it, I guess.
I think that's a great going question. To the person's partner, if they have a partner who you think you could would be helpful. You have to know some. That's tricky because then you're entering into this relationship. But
you wrote a book about this. Come on, which is for sale. What you wrote a book about this? What's
well, there is so one of the concepts in bullying prevention is the idea of the upstander. That kids are supposed to not be bystanders; they're supposed to stand up in a moment, and that does mean speaking out when it's uncomfortable. And the tricky thing about doing that is that you sometimes are in a situation where you're trying to read it quickly, but you don't really know what's going on. And that is, you can make a mistake. But definitely the message from preventing bullying is that bullying usually takes place in front of an audience, but when kids speak up, they can make it stop.
In the universe of kids, there is always an authority that you can go to that ought to be involved in a munificent way. With adults, right. There isn't. And so it makes it
right.
Trickier.
And one of the things parents often talk about is that they don't know how to address bullying by kids who have parents they're intimidated by or just not fond of, because that often the parents kind of part of the problem and there's no shared community norm for the parents.
Right. Tough one. All right. Let's go to a more pleasant one. From Nick.
My question was, is it really better to have loved and lost than to have never loved at all?
What's, and do you want to take a throw at that?
Well, I don't know, because I think presumably we've all loved. So, like, no one can really answer the question.
Oh.
Yeah, that's, I mean, isn't that always?
Well, no, that's not true. I mean, I had moments in my life before which I had not fallen in love. I mean, I'd loved my parents, but I hadn't fallen in love. So you could go through life with never without ever falling in love.
Romantic love. We're talking about. Yeah. Right.
So you could choose never never to fall in love, and it might be that might be fine.
Right. And if you fall in love and then really have your heart broken in a terrible way, and that you don't, that's like a rupture, then you would probably be better off without that experience.
Well, and it also depends what initiates the rupture. If it's the other person, or if it's, you know, if it's death or something on that, because that would change, I guess, I would imagine your, because if you're rejected, that's different.
Let's assume it's rejection. So you're, here we are. You're 18 years old, 22 years old, 32 years old. You fall in love for the first time. It is amazing. Person is incredible. You throw yourself into it and then boom. She
and
brings
about,
the hammer.
Right, and the person disappears, too. Something that, like, leaves you feeling...
She goes to the future.
That's torture. That's the worst.
That's that. She did use that line with me. It's like, I built a time machine. Yeah. That was interesting. I didn't believe it. But what if you love and lose, and then you never fall in love again? Like, all you've had is that fucking misery. That huge disappointment. Why is that so much better...
Right.
Than never having exposed yourself.
Well, if you think of romantic love as only one of a lot of different kinds of love and affection you can have in your life, then why privilege it? Why do we think it's the pinnacle? And then you can think of it as, sure, of course you would give up that kind of misery and maybe you would be better off. On the other hand, if feeling emotion is the most vital part of being a human being, then do you really give up feeling strong emotion, even if it's like the worst emotion? Because that is when we're the most alive, right?
Right. Yeah, you're the most alive. But what if you're, you know, then you afterwards, you indeed are feeling strong emotion for years. You're feeling the strong emotion of incredible disappointment and sorrow and loss.
And that can be really warping.
Yeah, is that? I mean, I feel like this is how, you know, Dr. Evil is the backstory for every villain is they've loved and then they've lost and it's just made them dark and bitter and disappointed and they're never able to love again. But I think the real answer is that we recover and we learn right. to love again.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it? A real POS. You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Do you guys want to pick one here?
What fictional city or other locale would you most like to inhabit?
Well, I grew up with the Oz books, so I would like to live in the Emerald City, married to Ozma.
I thought about that too, but then I was thinking, well, okay, so there's this like kind of weird monarch figure who's not really wise. They did a super job curling Dorothy's hair. Well, no,
this is post-wizard. It's Ozma. So okay, this is the Ozma ring.
All right,
but she is 16
better.
And I am 46, so that's... Also, you stay at your age forever, so that's another problem.
Do you remember anything else? That, like, are there enough specifics that we could be sure would be a good place to live? They were constantly having, in all those, there were always problems.
The Gnome King invaded a lot. But generally, no, it ended pretty well. And there was magic
What about Hogwarts?
I think it would be a bag end for me. Although, I mean, I'd have to be short. I wouldn't want to hit my head all the time.
Furry toes.
Bag end, what period?
Oh... Right. We could just move out old Samwise Gamgee. Sorry, Sam. I'm coming
Don't
in.
Don't you think I would have thought that, you'd that want, it would be so boring in Bag End.
Oh, God, no.
Nothing ever happened.
A little bit of the pipeweed
tea,
and your...
Lots
and
of
your,
tea.
Oh, my God. No, you just... It would be so gentle. No, it would definitely... You'd. I think...
Bucolic.
Well, the question, no...
It's
actually,
English
no,
country living,
to,
which is awful. It's totally stultifying.
Oh, no. It'd be so
really?
Gentle and lovely.
English country living is totally stultifying. Oh, no. Yes. Hmm. Yeah.
No, you would have good meals.
To be had.
You'd have
Well, if you had adventures, that's different.
Well, that's why your question is so interesting about what period, because you, if you're of an adventuresome sort, you might want to live there. But then you'd have all this peril hanging over your head while you were away, because you'd think that the Shire was going to get torched. I'm in a Samwise Gamgee mood at the moment.
Yes,
so
right.
I think I want to live there then.
And Hogwarts, because you'd be at school all the time.
Well,
yeah.
But
would you be a teacher? You'd be what would you be?
Oh,
what would you
a
teach?
Student. Oh, the short guy who teaches all about the plants. I liked that class
you'd be the
a
plants.
Lot, but I don't remember.
Can we give her an assist? Who's the short guy who teaches about the plants?
Sprout.
Yeah.
Sprout.
Mr. Sprout.
Right, huh, I wonder exactly. How they came up with his name.
The which house would you be? You definitely be what's the Smarty Pants house?
Ravenclaw.
Ravenclaw. You're a Ravenclaw through and through.
I think I'm going to send you to Slytherin for that.
I'm definitely if we housed us, I would definitely be the most Slytherin. You would be Ravenclaw. John
Thanks.
John you John is like is
sure.
he a Hufflepuff or is he a Gryffindor? I don't know.
Could go either way.
I don't think no. I don't think not Hufflepuff. Hufflepuff sounds like a rejected McDonald's
you
character.
You're
like
just
the Hamburglar and Hufflepuff.
Wait, oh, come on. John, first of all, you just said you wanted to be a Hobbit, which is the Hobbit is the Hufflepuffliest character of all time.
Wait, I have another idea. What about Sesame Street?
What about Sesame Street?
Living there?
Living on Sesame Street. You get to hang out with Oscar the Grouch.
How do you get there?
I don't know, but I totally wanted to live there when I was a kid.
I'll tell you. Let me. I'll tell you how. I'll tell you how to get there.
Tell me how to get to Sesame Street.
I don't know. You guys talk about you want to read books all the time. It'd be like sponsored. It's the letter A. Oh, again. It's
the
letter
A.
Oh. The number four, great.
You learn all that.
I'm not arguing for Sesame
There's
Street.
A store?
I'm going to be at Bag End writing with great ink and tea and farthing weed and.
What about the bar in Star Wars? I want to go hang out at that bar.
To live, I
don't want to live in the bar.
Okay.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
All right, we have a question from Liz Weeks. You're a presidential campaign manager for hire. You know for sure you want to be involved in this election. Opting out is not an option. The field you have to choose from is any of the fictional characters used in advertisements for children's cereals. Lucky from Lucky Charms, Trix Rabbit, Tony the Tiger, etc. Which of these characters do you choose to work for and why? What does their platform look like? How do you smooth over their weaknesses and highlight their strengths? Please be specific.
This is like an SAT exam question. Hard.
Tony the Tiger, obviously.
Yeah,
they're great.
Which one do you? The winner.
They're great.
Yeah, no, Tony the Tiger. It's also
he's orange.
Which do you work
he's
for?
Orange, ultra confident.
What about the Count Chocula guy?
Captain Crunch has been is a possible option, but
Captain Crunch, he's got a military, got a strong record of military service.
What about the right?
He's a captain. He's served honorably.
Yes, but let us not forget Crunchberries.
He's firm. He's firm.
Although I'm a huge fan of Crunchberries, but I was trying to make the case that Crunchberries was a huge deviation in his otherwise sterling career. But I love Crunchberries.
That's like his bad escapade.
Right.
Yeah. I think the problem with Count Chocula is that he was not born in America. He has a foreign title. No, you
though.
Under the Constitution, Slovakian. You should know, you may not have a title. You have to renounce all foreign titles.
Oh, David, the Constitution. Don't be so silly. We don't worry about that.
Yeah, it's all... It's your narrative is your narrative. My narrative is my narrative.
What's it,
so what is Count Chocolate? What's he running under? What's his campaign?
Chocolate for everyone. A chocolate in every
bowl.
Dessert bowl.
The Lucky Charms guy. It's strong economic policy. Gold standard. He'd be for the gold standard.
He would definitely
Morning
be
in
for.
America.
He would
like
definitely
the yeah. sort of hazy.
He would definitely be for legalization across the country.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a strong candidate. What he would be.
He's like
Gary Johnson figure.
Like, yeah.
Not
like,
very smart,
Jill
but
Stein.
Appealing.
Like many great American politicians, also has Irish heritage.
Right. I think it would work. I think that would be good. The rabbit. What is the tricks rabbit do?
I can't remember the tricks rabbit so well.
Tricks are for kids.
Tricks are for kids.
Tricks are for kids. That's a little sinister at this point. Tricks are for kids.
Anyone have any other candidates for that?
The Rice Krispie guys.
The
there
elves?
Are three of them, right?
Yeah.
Snap Crackle and
Pop.
Snap Crackle and Pop.
Yeah,
the idea of a honeybee. I thought
the idea of a co-presidency won't work. You can't have Snap Crackle and Pop.
I think you can sign up your whole family to be in your government and run your business. It works really well, actually. It's like
Are they brothers?
That's a
are
new
they
kind
brothers?
Of family. Yeah.
Are they brothers?
Are Snap, Crackle, and Pop, you would think maybe is the father.
I don't think so.
And Crackle are like the
no,
Eric
Pop
and
is just
Don
the sound
Jr.
Of the Rice
no, he's always trying to make that case, but it's just the sound he makes. You can't you're
they
not
all the, look the same age. I think they're brothers or friends.
Very close friends.
Well, let's do a vote. Who are our strongest candidates?
Tony the Tiger,
the Lucky Charms, and Captain Crunch. So,
what about Count Chocula?
Okay, we'll dump Captain Crunch for Count Chocula. Okay.
Sorry.
Oh, we'll do
oh
them
God.
Both. We'll do them both.
Oh
we'll do
my
them
God.
Both.
Okay, like so. Cincinnati, Captain Crunch is carried aloft on the shoulders of the people.
Okay, so your choices are me, Count Chocula. Captain Crunch, the Lucky Charms guy who probably has a name.
Remember, immigrants
and Tony
get the job done.
Tony the Tiger. Immigrants cannot be president. Okay, so who wants Count Chocula?
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Who wants Captain Crunch?
We didn't even make a case. Oh, we didn't make a case.
Who wants the Lucky Charms leprechaun? And who wants Tony the Tiger? I think it's a runoff. We need a runoff now
Captain
between
Crunch
Captain Crunch and
Tiger.
No, and
Lucky Charms. Okay.
Who wants Captain Crunch? Who wants Lucky Charms leprechaun?
Oh my God! It's going to the House of Representatives.
We get to. We can
Henry
now. We're going to vote.
Clay
now we're going to vote. The three. We're
going
to pass our votes. Yeah.
Oh, I vote for Lucky Charms.
Yeah, me too.
Huh? You are
so I don't
you
like
are
the
socialist.
Cereal.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think much like the cereal itself, we have gotten a little soggy, and we should move on.
John won't even tell us his choice between Lucky Charms.
John is really worried. The CBS
Forget
executives
it.
Might. They might hear.
There's nothing I can do to. It doesn't have to be unanimous. So I'm already beat. it's two Lucky Charms to one Captain Crunch. Right?
Yeah.
So
we didn't know you were voting for Captain Crunch.
Well, I mean, but I just thought I would move on since I was obviously beaten.
Okay.
We're just going to do a couple more and then we'll go to Slate Plus. So we're going to do one more from the audience. Julie Tagle, like bagel, are you there?
So my question is, would you rather be a public school teacher now or in the days of the one room schoolhouse?
Are you, and are you, Julie Tagle, like bagel, a public school teacher?
I am actually now an assistant principal of a public school.
Nice.
Awesome.
Nice.
Go to Ms. Tagle's office.
Seems like it'd be really hard to deal with the one room schoolhouse. All those different ages and levels of ability. Challenging.
Right, and you were probably only 17 years old when you're teaching in it.
If you're Lauren Ingalls Wilder, that's true.
That's the only model I have is Lauren Ingalls Wilder.
She had trouble with those boys, remember that?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, did you get this knowledge that you're talking about from a book?
also got it from a TV show.
I don't know, did this happen on the TV? I didn't watch the TV show, actually, I don't know.
John, what do you think?
Huh. I like the romanticism of the one-room schoolhouse. But it would have been, I think it would have, well, gosh, I don't know. It also depends on where you are and what public school it is. Sorry to complicate it.
What would be easier or preferable about it? You would be in a small community. You would maybe have higher status, actually. There is a lot of respect for teachers, perhaps. That's a problem.
Yeah, I feel like the student-teacher ratio is... might have even... Well, maybe, it wasn't better. Well, how big did these classes get in a one-room schoolhouse? Right? Because if you think it's like 20 kids, you would have, when you could just split them up, have them do different things during the day, and then you'd have like four, you know, seventh graders, and then you'd have four juniors.
It'd be a lot of lesson planning.
I think it's still a lot of lesson planning, and there's still an argument that it's a one-room schoolhouse going on right now because of all the different levels.
Ah.
That was well played.
So let's see. What are the better things about now?
You're paid more. You're paid more. I mean, those teachers were terribly paid in the one-room schoolhouse days.
Do you have more professional support or development?
You can live... A one-room schoolhouse is intrinsically a sort of remote rural community, and you can live...
In a city.
In a city like that.
And you could also have your own curriculum, I think, then, too.
Is that a plus or a minus, though?
It depends on where you stand, I guess.
Yeah. Right.
You wouldn't have tons of standardized testing to deal with.
But the bullies.
They would
read your book, which they would have bought, and they would just take care of those boys. So the 2016 election exposed a clear rural-urban divide. Try saying that twice. In the electorate, people don't seem to know about the concerns or hardships of their fellow Americans who live in other places or come from different backgrounds, or to have empathy for them. Beyond moving from the city to a rural area or vice versa, what can we do as Americans to gain understanding of people who live in different cultural or geographic contexts? And I would actually frame this as, should you get married to someone who has political beliefs you find reprehensible just to make America a better place?
Wait, that's...
That's a different question.
I know, but it felt like more interesting to me, that version of it.
More extreme and dramatic. Let's do the rural-urban juror.
What if you already know that this exists? It's a different question. It's about bridging it.
How are you going to bridge it?
It is different.
So
question
this is
for
kind of for journalists because we some of us spend all of our time doing this.
My answer to this is that you don't. So you can use social media as like a little. Bit of this by having a feed that incorporates people with different views, but you can't stop at social media. You can't think that that's your way of really interacting with people. You have to get out and meet people and talk to people and find opportunities to strike up conversations with people who are different from you.
Right. But how are you actually going to do that?
Well, you
live in New Haven.
It's not that
hard. Well, but she does it. I mean, but you can't make it a journalist. Like if you're a regular person, how would you do it?
I don't think it's actually that hard. Even so, I mean, I live in a really blue city and I live in a pretty blue state, but it's not that blue. All I have to do is drive for 15 minutes and I'm in a place where there are plenty of people who vote differently than I do.
Also, here's a slightly different question. So I, for example, my in-laws are Trump supporters, right? But they live in Queens. Their vote doesn't matter, and they, you know, they live in an urban, they live in an urban America that is quite similar to the urban America I live in. Is it more important for me to engage with them about politics, or is it more important for me to actually be physical? Is the physical proximity the issue, that we need to, as Americans, be physically more in touch with people who are very unlike ourselves?
I think yes. Just because that's part of the problem, is we all silo each other. And the human connection is crucial. And actually, you can't bridge that through social media. So you should get your ass into the rest of the country. And that includes both. And also, here's the thing, though. Rural America knows about New York City. I mean, they come to New York City. You don't go to Pocatello.
I don't think that's. I think that's the kind of classic Dickersonian romanticization of rural America.
I don't think that's
true
either.
It's like their perceptions. I mean, people's perceptions of what the kind of urban elite is like in rural America is as it's as misguided as my perception is what's going on outside of Pocatello.
And you know this because you've been there?
Well, I've been there at times in my life and in moments, and certainly I've talked to people from there and sort of felt that what they misunderstanding me as I misunderstand them. I don't know why you would ascribe that kind of knowledge and that kind of expertise to people. I know why you do it, because you like have this notion, that there's this romantic, like, better America that's in rural America, and we urban elitists don't get it. But I just think that's just like a load of hoo-ha, John. I really do.
Well, that would be a load of hoo-ha if that's, in fact, what I said.
But you were saying that they...
No, I'm saying they spend more time in New York than you spend. People come to cities.
That's not true.
I don't think people come to New York to see Broadway or to see the
But people who live in cities leave the city to go on trips and vacations all the time.
But they go to vacations into, like, rural Iowa?
They go to vacations in places with national parks sometimes.
National parks are rural America?
No, but in that world, people are different from you. Not if you stay.
Because in fact, the urban elite, John, travels a lot more than... The urban elite does travel more and is out more. And, you know, often
people
that's
take
going,
road trips,
often
they
that's
go
going to Austin.
They
don't it's leave going to the Marfa. Cities. It's going to I'm Marfa.
I'm not saying they don't leave the cities. I'm saying that they don't...
It depends how you get there and how you organize your trip. But certainly if you take a road trip, you go through the towns in America.
I just don't even understand where you get this idea, except you want to believe it.
Let's take it to the simplest point. Rural Americans have clear...
you know, well-conceived, well-formulated, deeply detailed, accurate knowledge of what's going on in the bell house. Which part of the city are you talking about?
I cannot keep up
with the things you think I'm saying. All I'm saying...
That is exactly what you said a minute ago.
Did I say that?
More or less.
Here's the thing. If you live in Sioux City, it's more likely that you're going to come to New York City than that David Plotz is going to go from Washington, D.C. to Sioux City if you weren't a journalist. It's just more likely that's going to happen. People are going to go through the major cities. They have attractions there more than people from New York City or Washington are going to go to.
But that doesn't mean they understand it better. It means they've made a visit to a place.
We were talking about proximity between people. That's where I was taking just the next step after that. I was not taking step all the way where you got me. I'm just saying we're talking about human interaction with people. So it's more likely that a person from Sioux City is going to come to Washington than you are going to go to Sioux City. So if we're talking about how do people from the cities come in close proximity with these people in their worlds, then your habits are different than their habits. Therefore, what would you do to change your habits to go to those places?
So two things. One is that when people are tourists in cities, at least when I'm a tourist in cities, I don't necessarily go to all the parts of the cities that are super representative or show me, right? You're in a sort of tourist setting, which is limited in its own way. And I also am not sure that I think that, I mean, who knows? We don't have good data here, but it's less likely that David would go to Sioux City, but not less likely that he would go to any mid-sized city or town in the country in
as
that same...
Also, by the way, earlier, weren't you saying that you learn stuff on road trips? If you can learn stuff on a road trip, you learn something on a trip to New York City, even though you're not
living. Learn something, but I my experience of visiting places is that the more it's a city that is organized around certain paths for tourists, less,
right? Yeah, yeah. No, okay. I'm not... I was not making my case on... I'm just saying their patterns of behavior are different, and they spend more time in the places, in urban places, than urban people spend time in rural places as a part of their habits. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there is a flight to the rural areas on weekends among people who make,
the Hamptons.
You know, yeah. Among middle-class Americans. Maybe it's happening and I've missed it.
But so,
Nantucket.
So forget Aspen. Aspen. Let's set this aside for a minute. To go back to the question, how do you bridge the divide? Is it really that hard? You don't have to go that far to find people who are in a rural area. Right? Most cities have a city limit. It's not that inaccessible. Right. And usually in your life, you know some of those people have some reason, whether it's your kid's sports, something that connects you.
Well, that's the point.
And then it's like, how deep do you let those... Yeah.
So your point about you go not to like visit just the geographical area, but you find there is some tie in community, whether it's religion or sports or, you know, some shared thing that allows you to bond over that shared thing and that shared humanity that then, you know, occludes all the other political stuff or doesn't even make it a part of the conversation. So that more than the geographical. Now, I guess if you put enough people in close enough proximity, they would discover their own common humanity, hopefully.
I kind of think that really living together is the only one, though. I think people do have to live together. I don't think it's enough to go even to do small things, that it has to be sort of lived experience over a serious long period of time. And that's what the lesson of the big sword is, that we just don't live together. And that's what's causing more and more of these bad things. I'm tired of just talking to you two. We're going to bring up a guest for the last part of the show. Please join us in welcoming Stephen Colbert.
You agree with me, right?
I don't agree with him.
I hate hearing you guys fight like this. It's just agonizing. It's like watching your children argue. It's so terrible because normally I don't mind you fighting when it's not in front of a live audience. When it's just you guys in the studio, I'm like, well, that's okay. I'm just sitting with friends at lunch, but this is unseemly.
It's in front of the kids. In front of the kids, honey.
I can't do this in public. There are people watching. We have company over. Please don't do this. I know this is how families behave, but... come on, face for the friends or something.
Hi.
Hey. Hello.
How's everybody been?
You know.
I'm only here to check on David because he's been sounding so fragile for the last several months.
And the rest of us not?
You, I know you can take a lot of punishment. I've interviewed you a bunch. And this one I get to see every Sunday. But David,
okay.
You know.
I'm okay.
Really?
Thank you. Yeah. I feel
because leading up to the election, you were really
I was upset leading up to the election.
Yeah.
But it's but I was saying to someone right before the show is that I'm a natural pessimist. I assume the worst is going to happen and so then I always feel better. I'm a happy person because I assume the worst is going to happen and then usually the worst doesn't happen and so I'm like happy about it. But this time the worst happened and so it's just it was kind of like what I expected. I listened to the show we did the day after the election. I've just sounded very calm because it was really...
You sounded medicated the day after the election. I wrote you about it. Like, there's a fine line between like professionalism and complete psychic implosion. Admirable, though. Admirable.
John also held it together, which was good.
You all did.
All right. We're gonna.
You are a rock! For me, the three of you are a rock for me on a weekly basis. Now, I didn't hear the beginning of the show, and I'm very happy I didn't. I had my stupid show to do, so I missed the beginning of your show, and I'm glad because this is my weekly rock. Like I measure out my days in Gabfests. Like every week is like that is it. To the Gabfest. Long may she wave.
Here's a conundrum for you guys, from Phil Goldstein. What is the most graceful animal?
I mean, I really like gazelles. I know that's a boring answer, but so I was trying to think, do you pick a bird, like a swooping bird, or do you pick a mammal? And I decided that the running of a really fast, graceful running creature is my favorite thing. I just want to be in that body so much when that's happening.
All right, that's good. Okay.
Any kind of animal, the most graceful animal?
Yeah.
Any kind of animal, yeah.
The ballerina Tyler Peck. Have you ever seen her dance?
No.
Jesus wept.
I think, you know what? I think a species, actually. Because, so she's in the same species as me.
And no, she's not.
We could interbreed. I think, I'm confident we could interbreed. I'm confident we could interbreed.
No way.
That doesn't, I'm disqualifying that. Any species that's not human. John.
I have a go-to answer on this.
Which
on all
is?
Questions related to animals, whether they be fish or trees.
George.
And so, no, the audience will anticipate my answer, which is?
Dolphin.
Dolphin. The dolphin's the most graceful, beautiful animal.
The panda.
You're just like.
They don't move much.
Why are you trolling? Why are you trolling? You're a guest. Man.
Uh-huh. You haven't answered yet.
My answer would be a giraffe, because giraffes are, they look like they're not going to be graceful, and then you watch them move, and they move so majestically.
What about how they have those really long tongues, though?
I'd say that's cheetahs. I'd say cheetahs, then.
Because
that's a good choice.
Because it moves so fluidly. It's the fastest land animal, and yet it still moves fluidly, and it can turn, and it is beautiful in repose. Are we in Slate Plus yet?
No, we're about to go to Slate Plus.
Oh, okay.
Our intern is Kevin Townsend. Our producer is Jocelyn Frank. Faith Smith produced this show, this live show at the Bell House. Steve Lichtai is executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Andy Bowers, who's here tonight, is the chief content officer for Panoply. We're part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/Panoply. Our show page is slate.com/gabfest, which has links to what we talked about today. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/gabfest. Our Twitter feed is @SlateGabFest. Our email address is gabfest@slate.com. Please subscribe to the GabFest in iTunes and leave a comment and rating. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson and Stephen Colbert, I'm David Plotz. We'll talk to you in 2017.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next, and I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.